You are listening to the MJ Murdoch Charitable Trust's 2019 Leadership Advance Conference. The theme of the conference was listening to others, hearing the voices of our neighbors. In this fourth conversation, our speakers are Steve Garber, Senior Fellow at the Murdoch Trust, and Jeremy Courtney, President and Founder at Preemptive Love.
Jeremy, thank you for this morning, for last night. It's a gift to all of us. Last week, I was in Central Europe for several days and lingered between the Czech Republic and Slovakia, and I had been there before a couple of times, and when you listen to the poets, the playwrights, the politicians over the last generation, you realize that these people have suffered terribly, actually, and I've taken that into my own heart for quite a few years now, and so was asked to come and speak for several days on where are we in this part of the world 30 years after the Velvet Revolution, after a time of remarkable hope and what might be in the world, and where are we a generation later? What does vocation mean for the common good in this part of the world? I remember several times last week walking through museums, reading books, talking to people, and just thinking, Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. This is a horrible, horrible history to think about. They've suffered terribly as a people, actually. One of those I've listened to especially carefully is Václav Havel, and have read most of his work and read and listened to him again and again over the years now. But of all the things he's said, which have been inspiring to people throughout the world, he has summed up much of his thinking with these few words: the secret of man is the secret of his responsibility. The very heart of our humanity is our responsibility, that we're able to respond to the world around us. We're not just stuck, really. Tell us a little bit about your own sense of responsibility here. Obviously, we listened to a little bit of your story, your wife's story, your story together. But where did the sense of responsibility for not only the world at large, but this particular part of the world come from?
That's a great question, and I think that the notion of responsibility is at the heart of a lot of our divides and our debates right now, because it kind of depends on where you put the accent on responsibility. Ought individual, there we go. Ought we think about responsibility first and foremost in personal terms? Like, I'm responsible for myself. That's the chief thing that I'm responsible for. Or am I responsible for society? And I think we can tend to put the emphasis on one or the other. I think the background in which I grew up in put the emphasis on self. That was my Christian background. That was my sort of political, cultural background. And it has served me very, very well. Let me add another word in here to responsibility, and you may see this differently, but I think a cousin of responsibility is the word agency. And I have grown up with a profound sense of agency or capacity to affect change in my own life, and I guess by extension, in the world around me. So I don't know exactly what the relationship is between responsibility and agency. I guess hopelessness sets in when you feel that you have a responsibility for something, but you don't have the agency to actually exert any change on it. And that's what a lot of our friends in this film feel. This is not meant to be a propaganda piece just so we get monthly donors at the end. I think this is what we're all going through right now. And we hear societies and communities all over the world saying, in the very least, I have the responsibility to take care of me and my people. But I don't feel like I have the agency given to me by the systems and the wider cultural powers around us to actually exert or bring about that change, that I feel a profound sense of personal and communal responsibility for. I got the personal bit, but it really wasn't until leaving home, leaving that womb that I talked about last night that gave birth to me. It wasn't until I ventured out from that I started seeing the span of my responsibility grow.
So, Jeremy, the word preemptive is a very profound word. It's a remarkable word. It's a word which makes us think about many things. The Oxford University moral philosopher Iris Murdoch one time put it this way: at crucial moments of choice, most of the business of choosing is already over. So talk about preemptive for us, because I think her insight into who we are as human beings, at crucial moments of choice, most of the business of choosing is already over. So what was going on in your life, in your wife's life, where this seemed to be what was next for you to do?
I think I largely agree with that. Jonathan Haidt talks about this notion of an elephant and the rider on top of the elephant, and talks about how much control over the elephant does the rider really have, and likens our rationale and our emotions and our affect to that dynamic, and how our emotions and our that which affects us are that's the elephant that takes us in a direction, and the rider on top is our rationale and our justification and our post-hoc language that we put around it. And so when the elephant starts to lean in a certain direction, then our rationale, our rider, our self, as we largely conceive of it, kicks in and goes, oh yeah, I want to go that direction. But the elephant is really what's in charge of so much of our life, and that which we think of as choice is probably not something we have a very good grasp on. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of what we've branded organizationally as preemptive, it's probably not. It's probably very reactive still yet in many ways. I think the argument for preemptive love, the notion of what we are doing as preemption and how we think about preemption, in large part, is that we've purposed that we're going to have to take a 30 to 50 year generational look at a lot of what we want to do in the world. And so what is reactive to the Iraq war now today, what has been reactive to the Syrian civil war in as much as we showed up after it went down, what is reactive in our work in as much as we're showing up to immigration border detention type situations, yes, that's all post hoc. We're not preemptive. We're not the first ones there. We're not the first ones to discover any of this by any means. But we are trying to preempt in as much as we know that we don't solve any of this stuff overnight. We got to think 30, 50 years out. Let's start doing the preemption today so that we're not living in this reality or even a worse reality a generation from now.
In the film, you show us terror and horror. Then you also show us smiles of men and women and boys and girls. And I found myself thinking about these words that I read in a Lenten meditation of N.T. Wright some years ago, that the vocation of Jesus is to somehow take into his own heart the most remarkable joy and the most remarkable sorrow. As we imitate Christ in our own vocations, we too will be asked to take up remarkable joy and remarkable sorrow. So tell us a bit about, you know, your walking into this world, your choice to live in this world, how it is somehow you do what I think is maybe the most difficult thing in the world, which is to hold together both honest joy and honest sorrow.
One of our core values that we inculcate into our whole team and culture is press into pain. And if you can't press into pain with us, you got to go. Like, you're just not going to fit. You're not going to make it. I've been touring this film and my new book that covers some of this terrain around the country the last couple of months, and having town hall open Q&A stuff after we do it for an hour or so everywhere we go. And invariably, this notion, this question, not put nearly as beautifully and eloquently as you did, comes up, usually in the form of, tell me about self-care. Tell me about how you take care of yourselves. And I think it's right and good and true that this conversation of self-care has emerged so much over the last decade or so. But I think I fear that it's leading us to a bad place. I fear that it's jumped the shark and that it's leading us to a place where we don't have the capacity and we are not telling each other, but we must press into pain. We must. Self-care is not the be-all, end-all of any of this. And so one of the responses that we've been... Jessica said it in New York City, and it stopped me dead in my tracks because I'd never heard her say it this way before. And she said, look, if you want to press into the most broken places of the world and help the people who are the most vulnerable and marginalized in your community or in the world, you're probably just going to have to get okay with the fact that you are going to live broken. If you can't live broken, then you're probably not going to be able to do this work. And I don't know that we've told the truth about that enough. But the flip side of it is, it's not a destitute brokenness. It's a brokenness that is full of such depth and joy. I never feel more without agency than when I happen to be in the United States and I see things playing out at home for me. So when news breaks on Syria and I'm here, when news breaks on Iraq and I'm here, I feel the way a lot of you feel. I feel hopeless. I feel scared. I feel like I don't have the agency in that moment here in a conference room to be with the people I know and love. But when I'm there and the news breaks, when I'm there and the bombs go off, when I'm there and we're getting shot at, when I'm pressing into the pain with my friends, I don't feel hopeless. We feel purpose. We feel like we're in it together. We feel like we're going to overcome. We feel like we're going to press through. There's just something about proximity to pain that informs our depth of purpose.
You've used the words to know and to love them. As I think about the idea of vocation, which is really, in some ways, the heart of my own sense of vocation, it seems to me the most difficult question, which we all have to answer in some way, and we do this with our lives, essentially, is can we know the world and still love the world? It's not an abstraction. If you think it's a hard thing to think that one through, like it's way out there in Syria or someplace like that, just think about the question, can your husband or your wife know you and still love you? And you realize that's a real honest question. It's a difficult question to answer, actually, because we have some sense of how broken we are, how wounded we are on a very personal level. But when you push it out and ratchet it up and say, well, this is not just personal, intimate, but actually it becomes public and political and global. Tell us, Jeremy, about in your own working through you as Jeremy Courtney and the vocation which you have. How do you know the world and still love the world?
I think I have moved through my stages of development through a combination of moving my body from one place to another and then allowing my heart, my worldview, my theology, my faith, my politics to catch up to the place where my body has moved. And that's not a guarantee, nor is it a requirement. We can do tourism around the world and be proximate, so to speak, to different ideas and different worldviews and different cultures, but we don't necessarily have to let all that into our hearts. We don't necessarily have to let our hearts catch up with the way those people do things. But to move your body into a place to incarnate, so to speak, and to fully embody it, that's a much riskier thing. And therefore, what it has caused in me is a more global world view, but that global perspective has not come by fixing my eyes on the world and saying, how might I love the world? That is an abstraction that I don't know what to do with. That's never been how it's felt or unfolded for me. The way it's unfolded is by moving my body into a place, being in utter vulnerability, and thereby coming to understand the generosity and hospitality of other people, needing them to save me more than me needing to save them. And their kindness, their goodness, their love, revealing my impoverishment, revealing while I may have power and I may have privilege and I may have money that they don't have, I'm actually the one in so many cases that is the poor one. I'm the impoverished one. And to be saved by them over and over and over and over, that has what has caused the unfolding of a global perspective in me and in us, I think, as a community. So it's never been about loving the world. It's always been about being loved by people and that opening up in me a capacity to love them for who they are as people. And somehow, as you piece that mosaic together over a faithful 20-some year journey plus or whatever it's going to end up being, God willing, then you look back and you might have a claim to being able to say, yeah, I do love the world.
Being in Central Europe last week, it was, I've been, you know, listened to this over the years now, but again, I was found myself just struck by the weight of talking to people who were of a certain age, who lived through the implosion of the communist world in Eastern Central Europe, and each person I talk to of a certain age has some story of terror that they tell, not because they get up on the stage and all of a sudden, yes, you know, and hear blurt out my horror, but their fathers were taken away for 2 weeks or for 3 years, and everyone has a story like that. At a certain point, I was last week reading in my own Bible readings for the day, but in Ecclesiastes, and it begins this way in chapter 4. Again, I saw all the oppressions that are done under the sun, and behold, the tears of the oppressed, and they had no one to comfort them. Well, that is true, of course, if you live in Bratislava, Slovakia, or Prague, the Czech Republic, and it's true, you know, in many places of the world. But clearly, Jeremy, you've taken this sense of how do we look at the way the world is, and you've chosen to somehow live in hope, which was a very Václav Havel idea, too. In all my years of work in Washington, D.C., I was often, you know, for years entering into the lives and the hopes and dreams of 20-somethings, and I didn't want them to become optimistic about what they could do to change history. People come to Washington, D.C. with often a sense of Potomac fever, which is, I'm smart, I'm ambitious, I'll work hard, and there will be change in a year. You just watch me. Never worked out that way, of course. I used to give my students an essay by Stanley Hauerwas, and he was distinguishing between hope and optimism. And I thought it was a very helpful distinction to make. And he argued that, you know, that if you're going to keep at something that matters, it won't be because you're optimistic about what all you can get to do because you're smart and ambitious and skillful. It'll be because you've been grounded in the honest virtue of hope, actually. And hope is not the same thing as optimism. So in this last shot, Jeremy, tell us about you and your life and how you take in the oppressions of not only the world at large, but particularly this part of the world, and choose to still live in hope.
In the spirit of some of what I said last night, I think the safety and the goodness of my fundamentalist Baptist Christian upbringing was paramount in this. It rooted me in something so sure, unwaveringly sure, impenetrable to questions. That was a safe place to grow up in a lot of ways. That was a safe place to be formed. And it gave me something really special to then dare launch out into the world with. Now, the shadow side of that became that I didn't know well how to grapple with questions once they came. I didn't know well how to grapple with ideas that didn't line up with the map that I'd been given that was infallible. But nonetheless, it did form me in a way that was really important and told me it's all going to be okay. I promise. In the end, everything works out for good. That's got to be a part of it. That's got to be a part of who I am today, without question. I would be remiss to not name the power, the money, the privilege that I have that is different in somehow in quality or degree compared to some of the people on this screen and people I live and move among every day. We're all exactly where we should be expected to be, given our journey, given our inputs, given what we had afforded to us and what we had withheld from us, given what society said about us and what we're all exactly where we would be expected to be. And because of all the things that I've had input into my life and afforded to me by this journey and this culture that we're in, I was shaped to believe that I had enough agency in this world that all things would work out together for my good and probably for yours if we all just keep trucking on. That's not been the experience of everyone. That's not been the experience of every community that I live and move among. They don't see every next step necessarily working out for their benefit the way that I have. And so success builds on success, and failure builds on failure. I've happened to have a journey where success keeps building on success, keeps building on success, both for me personally, for us organizationally, and for the people who look like me in whatever various intersections that means. That's a part of it. That's why I'm hopeful, because I keep winning in a lot of ways. I think the task and the challenge is how do we help translate or lift up a meaningful, robust, but also, as you have worked to do, realistic hope for those that who can't relate to that, mm-hmm. who can't relate to win after win after win after win, who don't just feel innately like we're so much better off than we used to be. Yeah. That's our opportunity and our great challenge between us, I think, interpersonally and intercommunally as we go forward.
And it seems to me that really is the way most people in the world see the world. So in some ways, it's a minority opinion that things just go well after well after well. Because most people, as I watch the world and see some of it face to face, have to deal with all the oppressions of history. And they just do, economically, politically, socially, culturally, historically. That's the world they feel like is theirs to live in. I'm going to give us a last word from Václav Havel. Because again, the question for me last week was, come speak to us about the idea of vocation and the common good. For us in this part of the world, 30 years after the Velvet Revolution, when everything seemed to be possible, when all the dreams were open and we could do anything now in history, because we were no longer oppressed by the wicked witch of the East. So here they were now. And Havel put it like this at a point, and I think these are words worth living by and maybe fighting for. Hope is not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that something makes sense regardless of how it turns out. And because we are people born of eschatological hope in this room, people who actually believe that, you know, as Gandalf said to Sam Gamgee, you know, that someday, 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 everything sad will become untrue. We do believe that, and we get up in the morning believing that, go to bed at night believing that, that someday everything sad will become untrue. We live for that, don't we? And that clearly is the idea of stepping into history with preemptive love. I have, for very important reasons in my thinking, argue that it's a responsibility born of love that ought to carry us in and through the vocations that are ours. So, Jeremy, we thank you for what you've lived for and how you live your own convictions out and what you've taught us today. And we ask God to bless you and keep you in the work that is yours. So thank you.